Today on Wings, social distancing stories from Canada, New Zealand, Switzerland, and the Philippines.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In much of the world, schools are closed to avoid spreading the virus, but some schools are keeping their teachers employed, offering online instruction. A teacher in Canada, who must remain anonymous, wrote down this description of what it's meant for her. When this plan was announced, I had 30 minutes to clear out my classroom. We are marching into uncharted territory and figuring things out without guidance. The first week brought my prediction into fruition. The Ministry of Education is throwing its teachers into the fire. We must figure out how to use new software applications without any training or direction, connect to our students, establish new education plans, and simultaneously report back to a million email messages, video conference calls, online chat messages. I really hate my laptop computer at the moment. Also, the new software application we are expected to adopt, Microsoft Teams, uses up so much bandwidth that it tends to crash in the middle of a video conference call. Privacy issues are of great concern, as is the issue of copyright for the materials we post. Plus, online bullying, which is such a problem that one nearby school district refuses to allow video conference calls. Others may follow suit. Some teaching staff are sharing their digital devices with their school-aged children and spouses who are also working from home. We have lost access to the industrial printer and scanner at the school, so my pathetic personal scanner will have to do. Some teachers can find a free online version of their class textbook. However, I have to teach kids from grades 8 through 12 how to speak, write, and read English across 5 levels of language acquisition, all in the same class. And I'm doing it for the first time. All I have that helps is a coursework book from a 1997 Community College Basic Education program. It is not online. Worse is the expectation that we will be available to students and parents 24 hours a day. Most of my international students have returned home, but will be continuing with my courses online, so I'm dealing with multiple time zones. Establishing firm boundaries with all parties will be my key to survival, because my students and their parents are addicted to instantaneous responses. When working with students in person, I had them trained to respect my rule. If the door was open, they were free to come in and receive help, or they could book a one-on-one workshop session with me. I rarely had a day in my teaching career without kids coming to see me before school, at lunch, or after school. They soon learned not to interrupt me while I was teaching another class, and that just because I was in the building did not mean I was at their disposal. Needy colleagues have to be trained too, just like the kids. With the online platform, I cannot simply close the door to create a physical boundary. Also, we are heavily monitored by our employers to ensure that we are actually doing something for our paycheck. I cannot simply turn off the computer or alerts to take a break from the attention deficit disorder-inducing reality that we are working in. Of greater concern is the mental health of our vulnerable students. Our education assistants, who had strong relationships with their individual students, are being redeployed to serve in other ways. When we met with students in person, we were able to read body language and ascertain if we needed to inquire about their current circumstances. I work with refugees who've experienced trauma on top of poverty and domestic violence. The online platform and lack of security makes this part of the job an impossible task. All of this is occurring when the kids know that the Ministry of Education is not counting any work from now through to the end of June. This means that if the kid was passing a one-semester course before the break, that kid will keep the mark and receive full credits for completing the course, even if only one quarter of the course material has been completed. If the kid refuses to do any of the assigned work, it will not affect the grade. When this pandemic ends, we still have to accept that the vast majority of the kids will be socially promoted, and we will have to reteach much of what was lost during this online experiment. All that aside, I am still grateful to be receiving a paycheck. I am taking a deep breath and will begin the battle afresh tomorrow. I have report cards to post, more than 100 email messages to respond to, plus the innumerable chats from my needy students who are communicating with me via Microsoft Teams. All I can do is take things one week at a time. But this quote, attributed to Antonio Gramsci, sums up my attitude. I am a pessimist of the intellect, but an optimist of the will. And that was a teacher somewhere in Canada. I read her statement to preserve her anonymity. Victoria Quaid in New Zealand looked at teaching from home, too.
At the moment, our school's open, but if there's a community transmission in the school will be closed. And already some of the teachers, because they're in the vulnerable groups, are working from home. But I had to do a survey last week of the students, who are mostly migrant refugee students, about the potential of learning online. And they don't all use the same software. Many of them are using their phones in their first language. So they're, you know, the Chinese students are using WeChat. The younger students are using Instagram. Some are using WhatsApp. And of a class of 10, they all had phones, but only 3 had computers.
Victoria Quaid's day job is teaching, but she also volunteers as a host of Educating for Social Change, a series on community station Wellington Access Radio. Since the station is closed indefinitely to all but paid staff, she started hosting from her living room. For the March 23rd episode, she talked with Dr. Prudence Stone, a PhD in sociology and CEO of the Public Health Association.
Kia ora, this program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Wellington Access Radio, make your voice heard.
Welcome to Educating for Social Change, brought to you by the Wellington Workers Educational Association. Call Victoria Quaid, aho. The Wellington Workers Educational Association supports adult and community education that promotes a more just and equitable society in accordance with Te Riti o Waitangi. Now, unlike most weeks, we're not joining you live from the Wellington Access Radio studios, but from my living room. This is because on Friday afternoon, Wellington Access Radio management announced that the station was closing its doors to protect station staff and program makers as the situation with the novel coronavirus develops in New Zealand. Programs will be pre-recorded until further notice because the only people allowed at the station premises at the moment are station staff. So welcome to our first full-on podcast. Part one, we talked to climate change activist and now actively involved in the Māori pandemic response, Mike Smith. And now joining me is Dr. Prudence Stone, a sociologist and the CEO for the Public Health Association. And the topic is the social impact of the pandemic, particularly how it affects vulnerable groups. Mm. One of the things that struck me, Prudence, is that a lot of the response has been aimed around Middle New Zealand, how this is affecting Middle New Zealand. Certainly, since Jacinda Ardern announced on Saturday the four level alert system for COVID-19, and she announced that New Zealand had moved from alert level 1 to alert level 2. That is, everybody is being encouraged to social distance. Social distance in this sense is maintain physical distance between people who are not already in your immediate family. This is part of the government's policy to go hard and go early in an attempt to flatten the curve, which means to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus in New Zealand sufficiently that our health system is always able to cope with the people who get ill. This is something that we all hope, but there are some issues in that our health system was already not coping with many of the people in society, or some of the more vulnerable groups in society were already had not great relationships with the health system.
Well, yes, it's good to talk about it in terms of social distance, because social distance is one of those things that always exists. It's not something that we're creating right now for the first time, but it's existing in very unequal ways for different groups. And now, of course, you can see the stigmatization of various new groups who might be associated with COVID-19, having particularly hideous social distancing happening to them in quite racist ways. Chinese New Zealanders and Italian New Zealanders are now at risk of experiencing new forms of quite aggressive racism because of really unkind responses to COVID-19 associated with social distance.
Look, people with an accent. You know, basically, you know, I live in central Wellington, and so there are always tourists around. And I noticed just on Friday people giving people with an accent a wide berth. Mm. Now, actually, Wellington's got a lot of people with accents who live here all the time. And they're not necessarily tourists, and they're not necessarily have any greater risk of carrying the coronavirus than anybody else.
So it's a great social experiment that's happening right now after we've had such an extensive era of globalization and the economy becoming such a worldwide web of trade between nations. And all of a sudden, the fear that crops up immediately with the spread of a pandemic, all of that having to shut down, and how many businesses are affected, how many trade relationships have to be renegotiated, how many workplaces have to send their staff home to socially isolate themselves or create some social distance to conduct a normal operation, or will it ever be a normal operation again? It's quite fundamental, and I guess says something about every group, nation by nation. The sociologists will be looking at the different responses to social distance and the way we've all had to immediately assume the same kind of social distance that has been always there for a lot of people.
One of the things that Dern said on Saturday was, we know how to rally, at her address to New Zealand. We know how to rally, and we know how to look after one another. And this, to me, is one of the big mainstays of New Zealand's self-image, that New Zealanders are kind, New Zealanders are helpful. And
it's a lovely thing we all like to think of ourselves in times of groupthink as a nation. We this. And it's interesting how leaders adopt that we in these moments to collectivise and bring us all together as a group. Mm. And that's a form of anti-social difference, to mythologise a we. But the risk there then becomes who's on the inside and who's on the outside. And that's why it can be quite a fearful way of thinking for Chinese New Zealanders or Italian New Zealanders, who some of us in the we group might be stigmatizing those in our everyday life, or coming up with all sorts of horrid associations that just aren't there. And that us and them sort of mentality starts when our leaders start using that we terminology.
Because it's very easy to say, well, you know, you're not part of we.
Well, look at the way the nation-state borders have all shut down, and it's time for New Zealanders to come home, and for France, for
example,
to organise their French tourists to all get back to France, a globalised community falls away immediately, and all of a sudden you do have social distance between nation-states back up in quite a cultural way. And I wonder how structural and permanent that might become. It's definitely one the sociologists are watching.
Sociologist Prudence Stone, Chief Executive Officer of the Public Health Association of New Zealand. speaking on the community radio program Educating for Social Change. The interview took place in the living room of host Victoria Quaid, with appropriate social distancing, they said. Only one death from COVID-19 had been reported in New Zealand as of April 9th. You are listening to Wings. Also now producing radio at home is Bianca Miglioretto from community station Radio Lora in Zurich, Switzerland. Bianca lived for years in the Philippines and keeps up with feminist and human rights activities there. She sent Wings a Skype interview with Filipina human rights activist Tinay Balabay.
In the Philippines, there is an open warrant of arrest awaiting Tinay Balabay. She might get arrested right away at the airport. The warrant of arrest against her is part of a repressive campaign by the Duterte regime to harass human rights defenders in the Philippines. She is the Secretary General of the human rights organization Karapatan. Beginning of March, she came to Geneva to prepare the human rights report on the Philippines at the UN High Commission on Human Rights, which is due in June 2020. When the first government measures against COVID-19 were taken in Switzerland, her flights were cancelled, and since she is stranded in Switzerland. She will explain first about the impact of coronavirus and the government measures on the people.
During the first few months in January and February, the Philippine government said that we are quote-unquote safe from the coronavirus. But things turned out badly, especially during the last week of February up until now, resulting to more than 1,500 positive cases being infected with the virus and at least 78 deaths. The impact of the coronavirus has really been taking its toll in the Philippines.
These numbers always depend on how many people get tested at all. Do you have any information if a lot of people get tested or only very few?
The Department of Health in the Philippines says that they have tested more than 4,000, but that's really a little, you know, of the population of 110 million Filipinos and more than 10 million Filipinos living in the capital itself, where the local transmission of the virus has been first found out. So there is really minimal effort from the Philippine government to conduct testing. So these numbers are really conservative at the very least.
What are the measures that the Philippine government took to fight coronavirus?
I would say the national government has taken more of a militarist approach rather than an approach that will prevent and mitigate the impacts of the virus on the general population. Despite emergency powers given to the president last week, there has not been substantial news on how money, public funds, are diverted towards the protective gear that's needed by the frontline health workers. Health services remain pretty much the same. Economic measures are very minimal to address the needs of the poor communities. The local government units have put up several facilities for isolation, for testing. They're struggling it out with the national government. Public transportation is suspended in Luzon. We heard that today in Visayas, in the middle part of the country. The projection is next week, that thing will also be done in Mindanao. So we're looking at a nationwide lockdown, which means no public transportation at all. To ordinary people, especially in poor communities, they're saying that it feels like they are under martial law, that they are being confined to their homes without any certainty of government support. It makes them feel helpless. They have lost livelihoods and incomes. They're being told to stay at home, but they don't have food at home. They don't have job security. They don't have social protection. They don't even have homes. So the virus and how the government has dealt with it has impacted most on the poor, ordinary folks in urban poor communities and in rural areas.
What if people have to go out to make a living?
Each household is only given one pass who is allowed to go out of the house. going out for people who doesn't have the pass means arrests and penalties by the government, like health workers, just because they need to go to the hospital and they don't have a pass, which is really absurd.
What does it mean for women specifically?
Well, for women, it's doubly hard because they're heads of the household. They're the ones earning the keep for their families. So right now, we are looking at possible increase of domestic violence, heightening levels of economic displacement because they can't do their jobs. In some communities, the passes are only given to men, heads of the household. So women are not allowed to go out. And if they do, they would be arrested. In short, we think that women will be in a more disadvantaged position because of the measures taken by the government.
How do the political activists react to the government measures?
Well, even prior to the government measures, we have mounted several relief efforts. But of course, these are all having problems because of the restrictions in mobility. There is an ongoing campaign by several organizations and activists and individuals to push the government to conduct mass testing and provide economic relief measures for poor communities. In addition to that, we are also campaigning for protection and relief for vulnerable sectors, like, for example, the political prisoners who are in squalid conditions in very congested jails. So we're calling on the government to heed the UN's call for the release of political prisoners, including pregnant women and nursing mothers.
There is a pending warrant of arrest against Tina Balabai, so when she gets back to Manila, she might get arrested right away at the airport.
What are the charges against you by the Duterte regime?
These are actually minor charges compared to the charges brought against many of the activists in the Philippines. These are perjury, meaning there are allegations that we lied on record before the court when we filed a petition seeking for legal protection from threats and harassment by state forces. These malicious and baseless charges were actually dismissed already last December. But no less than the National Security Advisor filed the case, revived it, and it has resulted to warrants of arrest issued against at least 11 of us. And I'm the only one outside the country when the warrants came out.
Are the charges the same for all the 11 of you?
For example, one of the nuns who were charged was facing trumped-up charges of arson and murder. These are the staple kinds of fabricated charges filed against defenders in the Philippines. Arson is an unbailable charge, which means that if they are arrested, they'll be in jail for quite a long time. They are not allowed to access the remedy of bail.
Are there other forms of repression against human rights defenders and political activists right now in the Philippines?
Yeah, as I said, this is just a tip of the iceberg that has faced human rights defenders, including their communities in the Philippines. The more graver forms of violations are killings, which has happened to at least 14 human rights workers of Carapatan. There are also cases of harassment and intimidation, especially in the past year. We are prevented from conducting fact-finding missions, even conducting humanitarian aid work because of the extent of the vilification and use of laws by Philippine government officials against us. None other than the Philippine president has called us out for like 10 times already in his speech. Carapatan is his favorite human rights organization to pillory before the public. We call him a murderous president who goes by a kill, kill, kill policy. And with a president like this, this is a very difficult situation for rights defenders.
How do activists that are charged now react to this repression?
Of course, we use all redress mechanisms, which includes the courts. We avail ourselves of the remedies. Other activists have keen interest in seeking political asylum outside the country. In the courts, we're also preparing in filing cases. We call them counter charges against those who continue this kind of repression. But at the same time, we're trying to build more domestic and international advocacy campaign because we think that any actions in courts, the domestic mechanisms are not working anymore because these are severely compromised by Duterte's allies in all branches of government. So the international community is a greater platform for us at this point.
You are looking forward to finally be able to go home to Manila. Aren't you maybe safer here in Switzerland right now, looking at the repression that you're expecting in the Philippines?
Of course, my physical and digital security, so to speak, is in a better position here in Switzerland. But I am looking forward to finally going home because I think the battleground is at home. We continue to live and fight alongside communities that we stand for. It's different, you know, you're on the ground and you can directly interact and organize people. So while I can do that here in Switzerland, I think there is much more to do in mobilizing Filipinos back home, where the battle is, especially if you're facing very daunting task confronting a president like Duterte.
So what is expecting you when you get home to Manila?
Well, we are expecting the coronavirus, of course. And of course, all the necessary stuff that we need to do and to help out in the communities in confronting the virus. But at the same time, we're also expecting much more vicious political repression. We may be looking at an additional 3 months of what they call a state of national emergency, which is de facto martial law. But we'll see. I'm confident that whatever happens, the communities that we serve will always have our back.
What is expecting you personally with this warrant of arrest?
Well, I'm expecting to be arrested in the airport. I hope not. They should be busy with confronting the virus, isn't that so? But immediately after my arrival, I plan to post bail because what I'm facing is a bailable offense. And then I'll go into 14 days of self-quarantine to keep the people around me safe and to ensure that I won't adversely impact them. But it doesn't mean that we'll stop fighting back.
Thank you very much, and all the best when you go back.
Thank you, Bianca.
Bianca Miglioretto produced that interview via Skype from her home in Zurich, Switzerland. Reporting from my home in British Columbia, Canada, I'm Frieda Worden. Hats off to all the Wings supporters and team members who are working and listening from their homes around the world. These include Lisa Hayes in Texas, Mindy Ran in Amsterdam, Sheila Dallas in New York, Michelle Schuler in France, Diana Wanyonyi in Kenya, Birgit Ayalo in Denmark, Suzette Cullen in Canada, Indu Smita and Manju in India, and Genevieve Vaughan in Italy. You can find Genevieve's work at gifteconomy.com, that's gift-economy.com. Stay safe, everyone. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.